You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. We're featuring a debate recorded this week at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse between the candidates for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. The district encompasses 18 counties in western and central Wisconsin and includes the cities of Prairie du Chien, La Crosse, Eau Claire, and Stevens Point. 11-term Democratic incumbent Ron Kind of La Crosse faces a challenge from Republican Steve Toft of Osseo. Toft is a retired Army officer and farmer. Please note there were some technical issues with the candidates' microphones at the beginning of the debate. The moderator is UW-La Crosse political scientist Joe Heim.
So would you please welcome our two candidates. Mr. Toft is going to go first for the opening statement.
Well, thank you, Joe. I'm Steve Toft, and I'm running for Congress because we need proven leadership in Washington. I'll work for farmers, veterans, seniors, and everyone else who's tired of paying a lot more than they need to in taxes, especially with career politicians who've never seen a tax that they don't want to vote for. And they're spending far too much of our money. So I'm born and raised in Osseo on a farm. Went to college in Eau Claire and joined the military shortly after I graduated. Yeah, I'm the first one who went to college in my family. I worked my way through college with 3 jobs. And when I joined the military, that kind of work ethic was very important. I started a young private artilleryman, and 30 years later, I ended up a full colonel medical officer. You know, it was terrific to be able to serve our country. I led tens of thousands of troops in peacetime and at war. My last medical job, I was responsible for all the military health care on the West Coast, throughout the Pacific, through Alaska, Hawaii, Guam, Kwajalein, Japan, Korea, and all the healthcare on ships, about 500,000 beneficiaries and about $1 billion worth of healthcare. After that job, I went to my final job before I retired. I was the post commander at Joint Base San Antonio. I had 85,000 people work there. I had a staff of about 9,000. You know, tremendous responsibility, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of business that we did on a day-to-day basis. And that was where I really determined that we have real problems in our government. Too much spending, too much regulation, and far too much waste. At that time, you know, I decided we were going to retire and come back home to Wisconsin to work on my farm. I met my wife along the way. You know, I'm happy to have Carla here in the room. She's also a retired medical officer, a nurse. And we came back home. I was working on my farm. I've never been a politician. But farmers, veterans came to me and said, you know, Steve, we need to have better leadership in Washington. You know, our current representatives have failed farmers. They've failed our veterans. And you can do better. You have led from the front all over the world, and we know that we'll have you at our backs here in Wisconsin. So I'm proud to be here, proud to have served my nation for 30 years, proud to have to be here and have this opportunity.
Hey, thank you. Ron Kind goes opening statement.
Any of you already know me. I'm a kid who grew up on the north side of La Crosse, the son of a telephone repairman. My mom, Greta, who's in the audience tonight, when she wasn't at home raising us kids, she went back to work with the La Crosse School District. My wife, Tawny, who's here tonight, she grew up in western Wisconsin, too, in a small town called Cumberland. And it's here where we chose to stay and live. I feel like I have a pretty good idea of what the hopes and the aspirations are of the people of this congressional district, but also what our challenges are. Our political system is sick today. Not healthy. It's way too polarized. It's way too hyperpartisan. We've become too tribal in our lives. It doesn't have to be this way. I feel that having served in Congress for a little bit, I'm in the unique position now to help know the rift that's developed in our nation. I think I've developed some trust and credibility across the aisle. That's why in a recent survey that came out of Congress, I was ranked the second most independent of the entire Congress, second out of 435. It's because I haven't been afraid to get in the same room, especially with my Republican colleagues, to talk to them, to listen to them, to get to know them, to build up the trust that we need more of in our democracy, to get things done for people back home here. And it's not happening. But it doesn't have to be this way. I think if we can put past our petty differences and start figuring out a way to come together again as Americans, rather than following leaders that seek to divide us, rather than pushing controversial issues that tend to divide us as a nation, there's more that we can do by working together. I hope we'll have a discussion today about what we can do working together to bring down the cost of health care. It's still way too expensive for most Americans. How can we protect patients with pre-existing so they don't lose that protection? How can we reduce the cost of drugs that so many people need here? It's one of the main cost drivers. We're on one of the premier campuses in America, UWL. $1.3 trillion worth of student debt is unacceptable. I have ideas on how to address that. So these students in the audience here tonight don't have a huge fiscal hole to try to climb out of for the rest of their life. We have an opioid crisis affecting most communities and a lot of families right here in Wisconsin. I've been working in a bipartisan fashion to address that. And our farmers are suffering. I just had a meeting yesterday with a group of farmers outside of Independence. And if you all could have heard the fear in their voices and the look in their eyes about the possibility of them losing their family farm after working so hard, all they want is to be able to sell to a good market, get a good price. There's a lot at stake in this election. But you have to be the ultimate referee. So I encourage you to vote, and I ask for your support on November 6th.
Okay, thank you, Ron. First question will come from Mike Thompson of WKBT, and that'll go to Ron Kind.
Thank you, Joe. With a caravan of thousands of migrants still making their way through Mexico towards the U.S., President Trump has sent thousands of troops to the border and said they will not be allowed in. Do you agree with the president's stance, and how do you think the U.S. should deal with this situation?
Mike, thanks for the question. First of all, we are a nation of laws, and we do have to secure our borders. And I support efforts to make sure that as a sovereign nation, we have secure borders. That's what sovereign nations have to do. But we're also a compassionate nation. And I want to make sure those women and children in that caravan are safe and that they're not being abused or taken advantage of or facing any type of violence. But part of our laws also include asylum seeking through the legal courts. And if people that legitimately want to seek asylum, they should have that right and go through that process in this nation. That's what I support. And I'm not sure, because we haven't had a briefing from our border patrol, whether they could handle that, but the president felt the need to call up active military for the first time in our lifetime to guard the southern border. I think we need to be exploring that more, whether or not it's necessary to do that, and if the border security that exists there right now don't have the tools and resources to do the job themselves.
Thank you. Mr. Kaufman.
So, yes, border security is national security. We need to be able to have a sovereign border to be able to have a sovereign nation. You know, I've been around the world. I've been to many, many countries. And where sovereign nations don't have borders, chaos rules. And we're moving in that direction. You know, we have several terrible problems in this country. First, we have 1 million pounds of narcotics and drugs, illegal drugs that were seized at the border in 2017. We have a public health issue with people coming across our borders with diseases that we've eradicated here in the United States, like tuberculosis. You know, we can't have those kind of things just walking across our border. And we need to be able to document everybody who is here in the United States. We have over 12 million undocumented people in the United States. You know, I feel that that we need to be able to have everyone be documented. We don't need to have people that we don't know their status here. They either need to be on a valid work visa, a valid school visa, or be able to, you know, to be able to be on a path to citizenship. So our country has, in this district in particular, has issues with guest workers. We have all kinds of dairy farmers that have illegal immigrants working for them. And we need to address the H-2C visa program so that it lengthens. It's at 10 months right now. We need to move that to a more reasonable period so we have predictability for our family farms that rely on this workforce. So absolutely, we need to address immigration. We need to address it very soon.
Okay, thank you. Next question comes from Mark Wirz of La Crosse Tribune.
The federal deficit has ballooned this year. What needs to be done to ensure that the U.S. debt doesn't reach the point of wrecking the U.S. economy?
Well, you're absolutely right. You know, the national debt is at $21 trillion. And this last year, we spent over $300 billion just on the interest on that debt. You know, we're racking up unmanageable debt for generations to come. You know, what we need to do is we need to curb spending, and we need to take an appetite suppressant. You know, there are endless places in this government where we can trim costs and be able to save money. You know, I came from the Department of Defense. We had, you know, just the Army says that they could save $50 billion a year just by closing the bases that they don't need, that are obsolete. You know, every congressman, every senator, every governor that has one of those bases in their districts fight tooth and nail to keep them open. They're obsolete. We can save a tremendous amount of money. You know, things came up this last week where the government spends money unnecessarily and frivolously, wastefully. You know, the Air Force was just called out on spending $1,200 on coffee cups and $10,000 on C5A toilet seats. And we just had the VA award a contract for $10 billion on a non-competitive basis for an electronic health record system, something that is needed, but that's in every agency of government we can save money. And, you know, that will all help towards the national debt. I mean, it's a travesty that we borrow money from China to be able to maintain the lifestyle and the spending that this federal government spends money on.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Kine.
Mark, I'm very worried about the fiscal insanity coming out of Washington these days. I cut my teeth, political teeth, with Senator Bill Proxmire. He was famous in the state for a monthly Golden Fleece Award for ridiculous expenditure of taxpayer funds. We need that type of scrutiny now more than ever in Washington. I'll tell you what we shouldn't be doing. We shouldn't be digging the hole deeper right now. That's why I didn't support the most recently enacted tax cut, where 83% of the benefit goes to large corporations and the wealthiest 1% in our nation, and it wasn't paid for. It's going to add $2.3 trillion to our national debt over the next 10 years. I'm a big believer in pay-as-you-go budgeting, and it's a simple concept, and it worked in the past that got us budget surpluses. It means if you're going to offer a tax cut or a spending increase, you've got to find an offset in the budget to pay for it, to maintain balance. And that type of fiscal discipline is lacking right now in Washington. And I also opposed the recent two-year budget deal because of the huge increase in spending that wasn't paid for and wasn't offset. But the real cost driver right now at the federal level, and it's true at the state and local and for most family budgets, is health care costs. We're an aging population, and as you get older, you consume more health care. And that's why health care reform is so important. And I've been a strong advocate of health care delivery system reform based on models of care that work back home here, from the Gundersons and the Mayos to the Theta Cares and the Marshfields, to payment reform in healthcare. So we're paying for the value or the quality of care that's given, no longer the volume of things that are done to us regardless of results. And by the way, prescription drug costs are out of control, and we ought to be taking action to at least allow price negotiation under Medicare to get the best price that we can for our seniors who need it. Or why not do bulk rate purchasing as we do for the VA and pass those savings on to our veterans? It works within the VA system. It can work in Medicare as well. So if we're truly going to get a grip on runaway spending and these astronomical budget deficits, we're going to have a much longer discussion about where health care reform goes so that we make it more effective, we get a better bang for our buck, and that people have access to quality and affordable health care in their lives.
Okay, thank you. The next question comes from Dustin Lukey of WXOW.
With incidents like the synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh this past week and a school shooting in North Carolina early this week, what do you feel is Congress's role balancing personal liberty with security?
Well, thanks, Dustin. You know, a year ago, we just had the one-year anniversary of Las Vegas. We've got nightclubs now. We've got theaters. We've got college campuses, high schools. We have churches and synagogues now. This type of violence in our society cannot be the new normal. I just refuse to accept that. And I think there are common sense gun safety legislation that we can and should be pursuing that's still respectful of Second Amendment rights. Listen, I'm a kid who grew up in western Wisconsin. I love to hunt and fish like most people do. I own multiple guns. But don't try to convince me that if our goal is to keep guns out of the wrong hands, that you can't have a background check system to make sure that they're not legally purchasing these weapons. Or the fact after Vegas, when the shooter used bump stocks, which turns a semi-automatic into an automatic, why Congress the next day didn't bring legislation to the floor to outlaw bump stocks? And I'll tell you why, because there's powerful special interests preventing that from happening. And yet today we've got people going to church or synagogue getting gunned down, and children getting gunned down in their school. That is the last thing that a parent should have to worry about here in Wisconsin when they send their child off to school, is whether they're going to come home safe at the end of the day. And yet, because of the power of special interest lobbies right now in Washington, these common sense measures are not being taken. And that's inexcusable. But we also have to come to grips with mental health. I've been a big proponent of mental health parity. And if we're going to try to prevent people with mental health issues from acquiring weapons of mass destruction, then we've got to up our game when it comes to making sure they're getting the coverage and the treatment that they need in order to address that. And I don't want to drive mental health patients into the dark with this, but we have to do a better job within the healthcare system of making sure we're treating people who shouldn't be acquiring these type of weapons to begin with. And also to make sure that that information is getting to the federal background check system so that they're not able to legally go into a store and purchase them as well. So I think there are steps that can and should be taken, and it's going to be, again, up to the American people as far as what steps they want to see taken.
Hey, Mr. Toth.
Absolutely. This kind of violence can't go on. We need to be able to take steps to be able to stop violence in theaters and schools, and we need to be able to communicate better. We need better communication between our mental health community, our medical treatment communities, and law enforcement, so that when the red flags go up, that we understand who's at risk, who are the shooters. And in every one of these cases, there have been red flags. If somebody would have stepped forward, we could have intervened. That's the kind of thing that we took action for after 9/11. We got our intelligence communities together, and we were able to develop a synchronized effort. You know, we need to be able. This is an important enough issue that we need to be able to do that. And you know, some might say that that's a infringement on civil liberties that we shouldn't take. But I think it's important enough that we be able to stop this kind of violence, and it's just something that is, you know, foreign to our, especially here in western Wisconsin. Just imagine if something like that happened. You know, we would look at the people that knew about this, and we would take action. We need to do that at the federal level as well.
Okay, thank you.
30-second rebuttal.
Sure.
Listen, I met with the Parkland students when they came to Washington. The courage that they demonstrated and the fear in their eyes about what just happened in their own school was something I thought would spur Congress to act, but it didn't. I do not subscribe to many leaders' calls to militarize America in response to this. Let's just arm the teachers. Let's arm the synagogues and arm the churches. That cannot be where we fall back to as a society. We can do better than that and be smarter than that. I've been having a lot of listening sessions throughout the district after a lot of these shootings, getting feedback from members of the community. I've never met anyone who thinks the answer to this is just militarizing and arming everyone, and it's everyone for themselves. I don't believe in that.
Okay, thank you. Next question comes from Hope Kirwan, WLSU.
After the Trump administration placed tariffs on imports of steel and aluminum earlier this year, trading partners like China and Mexico responded with their own tariffs that have hurt Wisconsin farmers. Do you agree with the Trump administration's trade strategy, and what should be done to protect farmers from continuing trade conflicts?
Well, that is a great question. And I can feel the pain of farmers because I am one. I've got a small 300-acre farm between Trempealeau and Jackson County, and I'm one of the growers of corn and soybeans. So I have a concern about being able to get a fair price for our crops. But, you know, not producing steel and aluminum in the United States is a national security issue. We need to be able to produce steel and aluminum here in the United States rather than be dependent on foreign nations to sell it to us. Should we ever need to surge and be able to, you know, ramp up our industrial base, we wouldn't be able to do that. Tariffs that the president has imposed or threatened to impose have brought the European Union to the negotiating table. We threatened to impose a $25,000 a car tariff on each BMW, Audi, and Mercedes coming into the country. You know, that got the European Union's attention, and they came to the table. Now we have a much better deal with them. NAFTA. We now have a terrific new deal, USMCA, that opened up our dairy markets to our American producers, especially here in Wisconsin, because we were hurt by that. You know, the Canadians were imposing 270% tariffs on our dairy products, and that's unconscionable. Now we have markets that are improving the ability for our farmers to be able to sell their goods worldwide, and that's a good thing. You know, we will do the same thing with China because they depend on us to buy their goods. You know, I'm quite sure that we will win with China, and we'll have a new trade deal with them, and we'll get to a much fairer and equitable trade agreement with nations in the Pacific.
Mr. Kine.
Hope, this trade war is having a very destructive economic impact on manufacturers, on family farmers, even on consumers now here in Wisconsin. We've got to find a safe landing zone for this sooner rather than later, before more economic damage is done. I do agree with the president on one thing. China has been cheating. They've been stealing our intellectual property. They've been requiring technology transfers. They've been requiring joint ventures. But here's the difference I have with them. They've been doing that to everyone around the world, not just the United States. This was a great opportunity for the President of the United States to show true leadership and form an international coalition to stand up to China and say, we're not going to tolerate it anymore. But instead, he took the go-it-alone approach, which only invites the retaliation that you had in your question and the impact it's having adversely on people back home. And I was all for modernizing NAFTA, 30-year trade deal. A lot has changed in the global economy, our relations with those countries. It'd be nice to bring it into the 21st century. But what we got in the recently negotiated agreement, and nothing has been finalized yet, is basically what Mexico and Canada were giving us under the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, a trade agreement that the president summarily rejected without even reading. And what we didn't get in renegotiating with Canada and Mexico was 18,000 tariffs going down to zero, making it cheaper for us to be able to export in the fastest growing economic region of the global economy, the Pacific Rim area, because the president withdrew us from that Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. So guess who's now going to set the rules of trade in the Pacific Rim? China. And we're going to be on the outside looking in, trying to compete in that race to the bottom. And in the meantime, our farmers with low commodity prices feel that this is just piling on. And the $12 billion bailout that the president's offering them, they know it's not going to work. I haven't found one farmer that's in support of that. And just to show you how crazy this is getting, we're going to have to borrow $12 billion from China to randomly distribute to family farmers because they can no longer sell their product to China. I mean, is this really where we're going with trade policy? We've got to be smarter, and we've got to be more competitive than that, than what we've been getting.
Thank you.
Joe?
Go ahead.
So I'd like to address really, you know, soybeans. Those are the primary crop at issue right now. So we are developing different markets for our soybeans other than just selling them to China. You know, Brazil is selling to China, and we're selling to Brazil so that they can sell to other countries. We're also selling to the Middle East. You know, countries that we've never sold to before. And you know, there's a finite number of soybeans in the world, and they are all going to get produced. And it is working its way out. I am a soybean producer, and I think that we are on our way to fixing that.
You know, Joe, talking to the farmers in the district just recently outside of Independence yesterday, all they want is a good, healthy marketplace to sell into so they get a decent price for the hard work they're putting in. You know, Steve, I own a family farm, too. I wouldn't call myself a farmer because I work with a local farmer, but we rotate corn and beans. We have some beef cattle in from time to time. My respect and admiration for our family farmers is unlimited. But farm policy coming out of Washington has worked against them, with huge taxpayer subsidies going to large agribusiness, which is leading to more consolidation in agriculture, driving up land values, making it hard for new beginning farmers to enter the occupation, and it's not fiscally responsible. I'll continue to fight that fight, and I've got the battle scars to show for it, but we've got to change farm policy to truly help our family farmers.
Next question comes from Brad Williams, Wisdom.
Gentlemen, I'd like you both to comment on the president's suggestion that he would like to change the 14th Amendment birthright of people who are born in this country, whether it is within his power to do so, and whether this issue should be taken up at this time.
Brad, I'd be happy to, and it'll be short. Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, came out and denounced that policy proposal. No one, the president or anyone, gets to change the United States Constitution by executive order, and that's what he's proposing to do by changing the 14th Amendment. There's a process in changing our Constitution that has to be followed. Even Paul Ryan, the leader of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives, thinks this is a bad idea.
Well, Mr. Kine and I agree on this. I too am a constitutional, supporter. You know, the 14th Amendment is pretty clear, and we would need to change the 14th Amendment to be able to do what the president wants to do. So,
okay, thank you.
Coming up, more from the candidates running for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. The debate was recorded this week at UW-La Crosse. The two candidates are 11-term incumbent Democratic Congressman Ron Kind of La Crosse and his Republican challenger, Steve Toft of Osseo. They'll discuss the issues of environment and political independence in the second half of the debate. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear a recording of the entire debate, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find other debates between candidates running for office in Western Wisconsin. Our site has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're featuring a debate between the candidates for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, incumbent Democratic Congressman Ron Kind of La Crosse and Republican challenger Steve Toft of Osseo. The debate was recorded this week at UW-La Crosse. We pick it up again with moderator Joe Heim.
Amendment birthright of people who are born in this country. Whether it is within his power to do so, and whether this issue should be taken up at this time.
Brad, I'd be happy to, and it'll be short. Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, came out and denounced that policy proposal. No one, the president or anyone, gets to change the United States Constitution by executive order, and that's what he's proposing to do by changing the 14th Amendment. There's a process in changing our Constitution that has to be followed. Even Paul Ryan, the leader of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives, thinks this is a bad idea.
Well, Mr. Kine and I agree on this. I too am a constitutional, supporter. You know, the 14th Amendment is pretty clear, and we would need to change the 14th Amendment to be able to do what the president wants to do, so.
Okay, thank you. Next question comes from Sheila Garrity of League of Women Voters.
My question is with regard to agricultural impacts on groundwater. Many parts of this district are seeing elevated levels of nitrates in the groundwater, much of which is the result of agricultural practices. Do you support greater federal regulations to ensure groundwater remains safe for pregnant women and children? Is there a role for the federal government to ensure ag practices are more strictly regulated?
Well, being a farmer, I have traveled these 18 counties throughout the district. I've put on 48,000 miles, and I've been in, dozens and dozens of farmers' pastures and vegetable growers, and talk to an awful lot of them, and they have the same concern. They do. They are all conservationists now. I mean, we all want clean air and water in this country, and we're blessed here in Wisconsin because we have the Department of Natural Resources, and they do a wonderful job of monitoring our water quality, air quality. And, we have modified our farming practices so that there's little impact on our groundwater. Even on my farm, we do low-till, no-till farming. So that's one of the things that you reduce erosion and reduce runoff that's going into our streams. So, most farmers, most agricultural people are conservationists. They want to have clean air and water. And I would leave that up to the state. I think the DNR does a great job here in Wisconsin, and we don't need any additional federal environmental regulations.
Mr. Kine?
Sheila, one of the jobs I take very seriously as a representative in this beautiful area is being a champion to preserve and protect our natural resources. That includes quality water programs back home here. You cannot grow a healthy community without quality water. And we have a crisis right now, not just in Wisconsin, but throughout our country, throughout the world, when it comes to maintaining quality water supplies and the human health effects that it comes. No one has had a stronger voice than maintaining a strong conservation title in the Farm Bill than I. Every time the Farm Bill comes up for consideration, I want to make sure we have a strong conservation title, which are voluntary incentive-based land and water conservation programs, working with our family farmers back home so they can put good conservation plans. So our number one export as a state isn't our precious topsoil flowing into the rivers and streams, down the Mississippi, into the Gulf, creating a hypoxia zone, including the phosphates and the nitrates that need to stay on the land. And here's the thing. When I talk to farmers across the district and other people, they want these programs. They want a strong partnership to help them put good conservation practices in place. They go hand in hand because they know how precious our environment is and the resources that we're in charge of are right here. So this Farm Bill is still pending. And I led the charge to restore the conservation stewardship program that was stripped out of the House of Representatives with the bill that they did pass. Over $1 billion of conservation funding assistance taken out of the House passed bill. It's one of the reasons I opposed it. The Senate didn't do that. I'm trying to work now to maintain that in the final version of the bill so that we're empowering our farmers with the tools and resources they need to be good stewards of the land and also to be successful at what they're doing.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
So I'd like to address the Farm Bill. Historically here in Wisconsin, we've had a congressman on the Agriculture Committee. Currently, we don't. We don't have anyone who's able to help write the Farm Bill, help shape our trade agreements, and help develop our world markets, or include important conservation parts into the Farm Bill. So when I'm sworn in on January 3rd, I'm going to be on the Agriculture Committee, and I'll be the first congressman in a state that is, agriculture is our number one industry.
Let me just respond by saying I'm actually on the Trade Committee, so I'm heavily involved in establishing trade policy. And the family farmers in Wisconsin have not had a stronger voice standing up and fighting on their behalf than I have been my entire time in Congress. Whether you're on the committee or not, it doesn't matter. What does matter is whether you decide to get involved and try to make a difference. And I've always tried to do that, fighting these huge ag subsidies, going to agribusiness, maintaining a strong conservation title, making sure we have a strong organic title. I'm chairing the Organic Caucus in Congress, and given the number of organic producers in Organic Valley, that's important to this region too. And making sure that we've got good ag research so we're developing the next best products. That's something I've been involved in. I will continue to be involved whether I'm on that committee or not.
Thank you. Next question comes from WKBT's Mike Thompson.
I think I heard you both agree that our healthcare system is broken. So I'm curious, do you think we should be moving towards a single-payer, government-run healthcare system and abandon the ACA altogether? Or, and more importantly, how do you think we should pay for these changes that are made?
Me? Yeah. Thanks, Mike. Listen, I'm in the camp of mend, not end the Affordable Care Act. It has done a tremendous amount of good, although it's not a perfect bill. We've had the fastest decline of the uninsured rate in our country since the passage of Medicare and Medicaid in 1965 under the Affordable Care Act. Now is not the time to go backwards. Affordable Care Act had important protections in it for people with pre-existing conditions. And I'll tell you what I won't support. I won't support a so-called health care bill that gives $800 billion worth of tax cuts to drug companies and insurance companies and asks 25 million Americans to give up their health care coverage to pay for it. Steve supported that measure when it came out of the House of Representatives a little over a year ago. Fortunately, it didn't pass the Senate, or it would be the law today. Because of John McCain's courageous vote, who happened to be wrestling and fighting cancer at the time, that did not happen to people back home. But when that bill was pending, my phone lit up. I had never received more phone calls than from concerned parents who had a child with a pre-existing condition who was frightened that they were going to lose coverage for that child. And it was a real fear. And I mean, that is going to be on the ballot come November 6th, like other issues are too. But I also believe that we need to be working on delivery system reforms, what's more integrated, coordinated patient healthcare delivery system, like the Gundersons and the Mayos and the Marshfields in our area. And we need payment reform. So it's value quality based, no longer volume based. The number of tests, the number of procedures, number of things that are done to us, regardless of results. That's what's been bankrupting us and driving up healthcare costs. And we ought to get serious about prescription drug prices. There's no reason why we can't have price negotiation under Medicare, or do bulk rate purchases under the VA, or have cross-border purchases like in Canada, if we can address those safety concerns. But the reason we're not doing that today is because of a law that passed Congress that specifically prohibits the federal government to even discuss price with the drug companies. You heard that right. It's illegal for the federal government to try to negotiate a better deal with the taxpayer dollar. That's wrong, and we need to change it.
Thank you. Mr. Toth.
So the Affordable Care Act is absolutely not affordable. You know, we were told that if you liked your plan, you could keep it. If you liked your doctor, you could keep him. You know, neither one of those were true. You know, the vast majority of people were priced out of the insurance market. You know, first premiums doubled, then they tripled, and then they became totally unaffordable. The average family of four right now, it costs them about $40,000+ before they get any insurance benefit. You know, between their high premium, monthly premiums and then deductible, you know, that is absolutely unaffordable, and families are making the kind of decisions they have to make to be able to eat or have health care coverage. A single payer system, that is absolutely the worst thing you know, that could ever happen to this country. You know, I understand health care. I ran a large health care system. And you know, if we had a single payer system, we would do away with Medicare, Medicaid, TRICARE, which is the military's health insurance, and we'd do away with private health insurance. And we'd have the same kind of issues that the VA has right now. We wouldn't want to have, doctors would not want to work there. Nurses wouldn't want to work there. I mean, we would have the issues with access and you know, we would have measures, you know, HEDIS measures that are, you know, quality-based outcomes would all decline. That's what all the experts say. So, I mean, we cannot afford, and it would probably cost, I've heard estimates up to $30 trillion to be able to implement that nationwide. And you'd have a government system that is, you know, not working now, and it would be even worse. It would be like it's on steroids. We wouldn't be able to afford anything else. We wouldn't be able to strengthen Social Security. We wouldn't be able to strengthen Medicare or all the other important programs that we need.
Okay, thank you.
Joe, if I may, and the last thing we can afford to do now is start taking away the protections with people with pre-existing conditions, you know, to be discriminated against in the health insurance market, or even not to be able to get any type of coverage at all. I remember a while back, there was a young couple that called me to thank me for my vote for the Affordable Care Act because their little boy, Henry, could finally get health care coverage that he needed. Because guess what? He suffered a seizure in her womb before he was even born. So the moment he took his first breath in life, he was literally uninsurable because he had a pre-existing condition. That's how bad that health care system was before. We've made some improvements since then, but we've got to keep striving for a better system.
Okay, thank you.
You know, and we do agree on that. I agree that we need to cover pre-existing conditions. Yeah, between my wife's and my family's, we have about a dozen people in our family with pre-existing conditions, and as most families do. You know, it's a common occurrence, and we can't let those people fall through the cracks. So absolutely, any healthcare system needs to be able to provide coverage for pre-existing conditions.
Next question comes from Dustin Lukey.
You've both mentioned over the course of this debate special interest groups in Washington or large departments like the Department of Defense. How does Wisconsin's 3rd District representative stand as a leader in Washington to some of these departments and interests?
Good, Dustin, I'm proud that I represent a district who I think has enough faith and confidence in me now to give me flexibility and independence of judgment in Washington. That's why I was ranked the 2nd most independent member of the entire Congress, because I've been willing to go there and stand up and push back against powerful special interests and the political leadership of both parties when I think they're wrong, and oftentimes they are. But you need to be able to do that. I've done it repeatedly under the Farm Bill. You know, it's not that popular with these powerful special interest groups in Washington for me to be advocating payment limitation reforms with these agriculture subsidies going to large agribusinesses. You'd be shocked, as I am every year, to see the number of federal subsidy checks going to addresses on Wall Street or Chicago and San Francisco. These aren't family farmers. These are hedge fund and private equity dudes collecting all this money because of what they've invested in. That's wrong. And I've got battle scars to prove the battles I've had with these special interest lobbyists in Washington. And I think Steve's right. I think there's a tremendous amount of waste in the defense budget, too. We've got our generals and our leaders in the Pentagon that submits a list to Congress every year of outdated weapon systems that they don't want anymore. Doesn't help with force readiness, doesn't help with the asymmetrical threats that we face on a global basis. Yet every year, Congress is appropriating tens of billions of dollars to keep these antiquated Cold War weapon systems still going. Now, standing up to those defense contractors isn't easy. They throw a lot of money around, but I've been willing to do that. And we also need to, I think, get a better bang for the buck when it comes to the healthcare system. There's too much overutilization, too much unnecessary spending that's taking place. And again, given the aging population we have in our country, that's one of the great cost drivers in the budget. But again, because of the recently passed tax cut and $2.3 trillion of new debt over the next 10 years, the fastest growing federal program in the federal budget today is interest on our national debt. And within 10 years, we will be spending more on interest on our national credit card than we do in our entire defense budget and in our entire Medicaid budget. Think about that for a second. That's ridiculous, and we've got to change that.
You know, we can fix the problem with special interest groups and their influence in Washington by implementing term limits. You know, I have traveled throughout this 18-county district and talked to hundreds of groups and thousands of people. And Democrats and Republicans alike all agree that we need term limits. Because when you get career politicians to Washington, they don't serve us anymore. They start to serve the special interests that get them reelected. Mr. Kind here receives over 80% of his money that in his campaign that he's spending on radio and TV commercials from special interests, from special interest PACs. He's not getting it from the district. He's working for them. He's not working for us. So that is the primary thing that we could fix that with. You know, I've pledged that I will only serve 8 years in Congress if elected. You know, because people think that's representative government. You know, that is, you know, citizens having real world experience in their communities, going to Washington, serving for a period of time, then coming back home rather than going and trying to make it a career. That is not the way to curb lobbyists and special interests. You know, they'd go out of business if you didn't have career politicians there who were depending on them. So,
you know, Joe, those special interest contributions coming to me are from real people, from right here in the congressional district. We've got over 3,000 individual contributors who, on average, contribute less than $100 to my campaign. But I'll tell you this, it's not the length of service that matters, it's the attitude of the representative and what they take with them to Washington. And unfortunately, recently, too many of my colleagues are coming to Washington with this my way or no way at all attitude. No cooperation, no compromise. That's not how I've dealt. That's why, again, I'm the fourth most bipartisan member, the second most independent. That attitude is what has to change. It's like if I came home one night and told my wife, Tony, I got this great new idea on how decisions are going to be made in our family. It's going to be my way or no way at all. She'd throw me out on my butt. She wouldn't tolerate that for a second. Why are we doing that in our democracy? It doesn't make any sense.
Can I respond to that last?
Go ahead.
So Ron is the second out of 435 most independent. You know, what does that mean? You know, he has co-sponsored bills, you know, more, you know, frequently than only one other congressman. That's because you've been there for an awful long time, and you sign on to bills when they're already going to pass or they're already going to fail. That's the truth of it. If you look at his voting record, it's not bipartisan. He votes with Nancy Pelosi and his party 90% of the time, and that's not bipartisan. That's not independent.
I'm sorry, Steve doesn't like the surveys that are judging us out in Washington, but the facts are the facts. And the fact is, if you're going to be successful in Congress, it's better to work in a bipartisan way. And when I draft legislation, I actively seek a Republican sponsor to be on the bill with me. And here's the secret sauce. I put their name first because they're in the majority. Chances are their bill is going to get considered rather than someone in the minority. And that's why I've been so successful legislatively of getting things done, and why I consistently rank as one of the most independent and bipartisan members of Congress. I think we need more of that these days in both Washington and Madison.
Thank you. We're now going to go to closing statements, and Mr. Kine goes first.
Thank you, Joe. Again, thank the panelists for your questions and for everyone in the audience participating. Listen, we face a seminal moment, a key decision point in our democracy. I'm encouraging people, if you haven't registered yet, please register. And if you are registered, vote early. And don't, you know, avoid the lines on November 6th or maybe bad weather. But we need everyone to be participating. Your voices matter. And again, I ask for your support. Listen, I thought about what I wanted to say in my closing arguments, and I went back to history. I want to read you something that was going to be said. It was words written for the end of a speech that John F. Kennedy planned to give in Austin, Texas, on November 22nd, 1963, at the end of the day. Of course, he never had that opportunity to deliver this speech, but this is what he wanted to say, and I quote, "Neither the fanatics nor the faint of hearted are needed, and our duty as a party is not to our party alone, but to the nation, and indeed to all mankind. Our duty is not merely the preservation of political power, but the preservation of peace and freedom. So let us not be petty over our cause. Let us not quarrel amongst ourselves when our nation's future is at stake. And let us stand together with renewed confidence in our cause, united in our heritage of the past and a renewed hope for the future." And I'm afraid too many people now are approaching this election and the political system out of fear and anger rather than hope and optimism and inspiration. Somehow we have to recapture that hope and inspiration again as a country. We've got to heal the rift that's been developed. Lincoln called upon our better angels of ourselves. He called back on the mystic cords of memory that unites us as Americans, the common bonds that we share first as Americans, as opposed to Republicans, Democrats, or independents. We need that attitude in public service. We need that attitude back home. What our state of democracy is not in a healthy place. It is not sustainable the way things are going. I feel I can make a difference, and that's why, again, I ask for your support on November 6th.
Thank you. Mr. Toth.
Our district faces an important decision next week, whether to continue to reelect a career politician who serves special interests in Washington and does not serve the people of this district, or a career soldier rather than a career politician, someone who has served his country all around the world, someone who is a farmer, a veteran, a military and a healthcare expert, and a leader, someone that has fought for freedom, has led tens of thousands of troops, have brought people together from every corner of this nation, from California to New York to Kansas to Wisconsin, to accomplish.
Steve Toft of Osseo is the Republican candidate for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. He's challenging 11-term Democratic Congressman Ron Kind of La Crosse. The district includes 18 counties in western and central Wisconsin, including the cities of La Crosse, Stevens Point, and Eau Claire. The debate was recorded this week at UW La Crosse. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. To hear a recording of the entire debate featured in today's show, you can find the audio archives at WPR.org/newsmakers. You'll also find other debates between candidates running for office in western Wisconsin. Our site has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at WPR.org/newsmakers.